Let's bring on Seth Partnow of Nylon Calculus, a part of the HP Basketball Network, joining us. He is the managing editor of Nylon Calculus. Seth, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Thanks for joining us. You're on with Zach and I, so we always love having you on the show. How are you doing? You're in Alaska again tonight, right?
Yep. In Anchorage after spending a day in the western edge of civilization that is Bethel yesterday.
Really? How many people live in Bethel?
That is an excellent question, which I should have researched. Not that many.
It's just a small western Alaskan city.
Yes.
Okay. Jazz are going to hack Capella, by the way. This is like the second time all season they've hacked someone.
Got to hack somebody.
Anyway, we have specific questions for you, I promise. You did a great piece yesterday on offensive rebounding, and in particular, whether or not it's kind of a good strategy for teams and how much of an impact it makes. Will you kind of tell our listeners what you ended up finding?
Sure. So Zach Lowe wrote about offensive rebounding this week, and it's something that a lot of people have been talking about this year, and for a few years really, is how offensive rebounding has kind of dropped both across the league and in terms of its seeming importance, because teams have kind of realized that one of the best ways to prevent fast break baskets is to get back on defense instead of crash the offensive boards. And so that's the popular notion, is that teams kind of starting with Doc Rivers' Celtics teams were one of the first major teams that did this, and now I think the Hornets are fairly extreme in that tendency as well, just in terms of conceding defensive rebounds for the most part and getting back on defense. Hmm. Another aspect of it I want to look at is also just who is shooting from where, and because in the past I've found that offensive rebound rates are pretty heavily influenced by, you know, which guy on the floor is taking the shot. The example I used in the piece was Andre Drummond missing a layup is a pretty common offensive rebound because he is an amazing offensive rebounder. And if he's missing a layup, he's already right near the basket to get the offensive rebound versus kind of a big man shooting a jump shot. I guess the crux of the piece was that the increase in three-pointers we've seen, especially among people playing power forwards, might have as much to do with the drop in offensive rebounding, if that makes sense. So some of the guys who would normally be crashing the most are now standing 24 feet from the basket and shooting, not necessarily in a position to contest for a rebound.
Interesting. So is that a good strategy to use, or is it just kind of, you know, look, the NBA has changed, and so this is a big reason why the offensive rebounding numbers have declined so much in the last 5 years?
I would say it's something that is, whether or not it's a good or bad thing, I think depends a lot on each specific team. I think a team like the Jazz, for example, are kind of pretty dependent on offensive rebounds just by nature of kind of their personnel, and maybe that's a an argument against, even as his jump shot improves, an argument against, you know, Derek Favors spacing out that far, for example, when they, in the mythical time at this point, when they returned, the team returns to full health. Now that I guess Rodney Hood got injured tonight, I think I saw.
Right. Rudy Gobert comes back and then Rodney Hood gets injured in the same game. It's perfect. But regardless.
And so that's a kind of a complicated thing when people talk about, well, why doesn't Blake Griffin or LaMarcus Aldridge or Anthony Davis shoot more threes? Well, there's a trade-off there. And it's not just the shots they take, but all the times that they're standing that far from the basket when they don't shoot. And it just kind of takes them away from the basket. And that's a trade-off. And whether or not it's worth it, it probably depends a lot on the team and the opponent and everything else.
So, Seth, if you were coaching an NBA team, would you have them crash the boards? I mean, I guess it's personnel dependent, but isn't there kind of the idea that if you crash the boards, well, then they have to send other rebounders to go grab a rebound, and then maybe that allows less or fewer opportunities to get out on the break?
I think I probably would go for crashing more from the bigs and try to set up an offense where the the wings were able to get back more. One of the problems is with the kind of the advent of the corner three, is that's actually a tough spot to get back on D from. So you have, you know, my daughter wants to join us. the two wings are kind of stationed in the corners, and all of a sudden, you know, they're almost out of the play, either for offensive rebounding or getting back on defense. So that almost makes it tough to have both bigs crash,
right?
Because then the only person who could get back is the point guard, and now you're giving up, you know, 3-on-1s
right,
with only your point guard back, and that's not an ideal spot. So again, it's tough. Apologies for the semi pun. Tough calculus to figure out how to balance that between like an efficient offense and then balance getting back on defense.
Yeah, I thought both you and Zach had good looks at that yesterday on Nylon Calculus, and then Zach, of course, on ESPN.com. And it is something that kind of coaches are weighing right now, especially I think this is something that Quinn Snyder thinks about a lot, is like, look, this is what our team is good at, this offensive rebounding thing. But ultimately, it's not necessarily correlated with like winning, which is obviously kind of a worry. And, you know, maybe you do, and he's so focused on defense and so focused on transition defense, especially, that maybe it's not the right thing. It's a weird catch-22 that you kind of play, especially with a roster like the Jazz's.
Yeah, I think that the correlation with winning, I think that it should be, you need to recognize that it's still just a correlation. I think that's, at this point, it's more the teams that are winning don't necessarily have the personnel to be great offensive rebounding teams. Though it should be noted that for most of this year, the Warriors have actually been an excellent offensive rebounding team, relatively speaking. So that's one side of it. And the other side, and this is something that a piece that I linked to in my piece, someone named Brian Skinner did an interesting look at kind of figuring out the literally the calculus of that the go for the rebound or not decision. The better an offensive rebounding team you are, the more you should go for offensive rebounds. So the fact that the Jazz are good at it indicates, you know, by virtue of personnel, both, you know, Gobert and Favors and then Trevor Brook are off the bench. That indicates that they probably should be more aggressive going for offensive rebounds than the average team, because they'll be more successful. And since they're more successful, it helps them on offense and doesn't hurt them on defense as much.
Quick update on the Jazz game, and since you mentioned Rudy Gobert, Rudy Gobert did just sub out of the game with 2 minutes left. Jazz are now down 6, 96-90. Rudy Gobert was on the minutes restriction coming in, so it's not that surprising coming out. He's now played 15 minutes in tonight's game, ended up a +7, the highest on the Jazz, but thought I'd let our listeners know about that. I actually wanted to ask you about the Jazz's offense. You mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but you were trying to figure out how it is that the Jazz's offense has been as efficient as it is. I mean, it's been kind of around the 10th range in terms of NBA teams so far this season when you look at offensive rating. Have you been able to come up with kind of a pat explanation for why the Jazz have been so effective offensively this year?
No, the short version. I think that, you know, they're doing decently at some little things. They don't turn the ball over a whole ton. They get to the free throw line a lot. They're good offensive rebounding, good at offensive rebounding. But they don't do a great job of playmaking for each other, which is something that tends to correlate with you know, efficient offense. So the short answer is, I'm not really sure. Maybe they've got some guys who are maybe hitting shots more than you can necessarily expect. I know that Neto's 3-point percentage has kind of dropped as the season has gone along, but is
still like 40%.
More,
yeah,
better than you would have expected of him, given the scouting report on him coming in. Rodney Hood is, when healthy, has been up and down, but as someone who can certainly create for himself and others a little bit, I don't know. There's no easy explanation for it, other than they've kind of have probably just made a few more shots than we would have thought they would have, given the looks they're getting.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair thing. I mean, it's interesting because the Jazz, you know, coming into the season and really especially coming out of last one, thought that they were a defensive-minded team, and yet so far, and admittedly, Rudy Gobert's been out for much of the season, but they've been a better offensive team than they've been a defensive team on a per-possession basis.
Yeah, and I think that with Gobert back, I mean, I think he's such a massively impactful defensive player that at the very least their defense will come back up, probably not to the level of the second half of last year, just because that doesn't seem plausible unless you're this year's Spurs.
Right.
Whether or not they can actually maintain that sort of offense, and if, especially as he's kind of working his way back into form, if Gobert might actually be a little bit of a drag on the offense in the short term.
Speaking of offenses that actually drive me crazy, and we talked about
yes,
we talked about. Well, actually, I'm not going with the Wolves just yet, but okay. I am going to ask you a Wolves question.
Oh, okay.
The Rockets actually, I don't like the way they shoot threes, and you've played basketball with me. I've played basketball with Seth. Seth can flat out shoot.
Yeah, by the way. So he can.
For the people who don't,
I've
know.
I've had to guard him before.
It's a nightmare. And so Houston seems to have like found that cliff of like too many threes to where they're not that efficient of an offense. But are they not that efficient of an offense because they shoot too many threes, or is it because they're hunting contact, or is it because everyone hates each other?
It's funny you bring this up. I actually just pitched a story on this today, and I'll be writing on it in the next couple of days. I think they just don't have a lot of good shooters.
Yeah.
Some of it, I think, is the fact that when you kind of, I don't know whether it's you're starting to hunt the less efficient threes now, or if you kind of take the deception of threatening from whole areas of the court kind of off the table, if that makes it easier to guard, or the fact that they are so encouraged to shoot threes that maybe, you know, I'm not really in rhythm here, but I'm going to shoot this anyway because it's a three. That's good. And I think all of those things, and as well as kind of whatever kind of internal turmoil stuff has been going on with them, which, you know, I don't know anything about specifically, but it's hard to avoid the thought that something hasn't been right with their team much of the year. I think all of those things certainly play a part with it. But are they, in offensive terms, are they underperforming their talents? Are they performing to their talents? Is their system preventing them? Or is it just they have, you know, one really great offensive player and a bunch of guys who aren't? And this is kind of, and almost no matter which way you slice it, this is what, how you get there might be different, but you get kind of an okay to good, but not great offense out of that. And having not yet written the piece, I don't know the answer to that. but that's certainly something I'm very interested in investigating, because I think it's been something that we've seen not just this year, but over the last few years of kind of the Harden dominated system is, you know, by kind of quote unquote objective terms, they are getting good shots, which in their hands turn into less good shots. And how much of that is, like I said, that lack of deception versus just not having good shooters taking the shots.
Okay, yeah. Now I'm going to ask you about the offense that drives me the most crazy, which is the Timberwolves. they are having a 90s night pretty soon. They advertise that today with like a cool Saved by the Bell Photoshop of Ricky Rubio and Shabazz Muhammad as Zach and Slater. So I'm looking forward to that. Is that the night that Sam Mitchell looks like a genius?
If we were closer to Passover, I might say what makes that night different than all other nights.
Sure.
This is actually always kind of a tough topic to talk about now. I wrote about this some over the summer, and, you know, looking back at those pieces, they all talked a lot about Flip Saunders, which makes it, you know, you feel a little bit bad talking about it.
Sure.
Just in general, just the way that and it's worth remembering that, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, Flip was his system was genuinely innovative and kind of state of the art. And the problem is it hasn't that system, and you see it both in Minnesota and prior to this year in Washington with Randy Whitman, that it didn't necessarily adopt to the modern NBA in terms of both rule changes and defensive style. And this has been a topic the last couple of days and amongst, you know, Wolves writers and tweeters and stuff like that, is it's hard to say, you know, what you've learned about, you know, some of the young players they have, because you're not really sure how they would look in a system that's more like what teams in the NBA, most teams in the NBA are doing these days.
Well, I also do wonder, you know, could you just take that system and stretch it out 5 feet? Like, would that work in any way?
Maybe, but so much of the stuff is kind of, you know, that elbow entry and kind of those slice cuts across the top, and you can't really, like, if you change the angle, like just thinking off on my feet now, you know, you change the angle on that cut and you make that diagonal pass across the top of the key instead of to a guy cutting off the elbow, maybe that turns into like a steal and a dunk the other way too often, right? Or something like that. And just beyond that, it's just, you know, and I think we've talked about this before, just where guys catch the ball just does not put them in positions to, you know, threaten vulnerable areas of the court. If you know, Andrew Wiggins is catching the ball at 20 feet, why would anyone have to close out on hard? He's not a great 3-point shooter by any means yet, but if someone with his athleticism, or an even better example, Zach LaVine, is catching the ball at 24 feet, he's a good enough shooter that you have to run at him. Now, all of a sudden, he has this pretty simple, all right, the guy's not going to get here, I'm shooting this catch and shoot three, or the guy's coming out at me too hard, I'm going to go to the basket and dunk on everybody. And, you know, making the game kind of very simple for him would seem to be a really good way of maximizing his gifts and kind of hiding some of the decision-making weaknesses that I think we've all kind of seen and lamented in the Zach LaVine point guard experiments.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Let me change, like, tacks a little bit to this Jeremiah Singleman study that was kind of floating around Twitter yesterday and today with regards to size versus adjusted plus minus. And in particular, he found that lineups with more size overall are much better defensively, but much worse offensively. I guess maybe much is strong, but better defensively and worse offensively. So again, small teams, better offense, big teams, better defense. I guess that's not a surprising result, but I was surprised that it wasn't a clear, there wasn't a clear answer whether or not you should play kind of small lineups compared to big lineups. I guess I would have expected, given the success of the Warriors and the Heat a little bit in playing small sometimes, that maybe there'd be more positives to playing small than showed in Jeremiah's study. What were your thoughts when you saw that?
I agree with you that it wasn't, it's sort of a confirmation of something we've sort of known or at least suspected for a long time. And that's pretty valuable in and of itself, just to kind of confirm that bit of wisdom. Part of it is, I think that the effect is probably somewhat muddied by, you know, a team like the Warriors. Most teams don't necessarily stay big against them. Mm-hmm. So that possibly kind of diminishes the effect a little bit, because a team is then goes and plays small versus them, but by playing small, they're not necessarily playing their best guys, so they're putting a worse lineup on the floor, and that does all kinds of kind of interesting in nerdy air quotes interesting things to kind of the statistical methodology of it, or within the statistical methodology. So it's hard to necessarily tease out better or worse. I think, like we talked about with the offensive rebounding, it's much better to do what your team does best than to try to get, you know, caught up in kind of, this is the quote unquote optimal way to play if we had, you know, whatever personnel we had. I think, you know, in the off season, maybe that's a better time to start thinking about, do we want to be, you know, make a decision like the Pacers did last year?
Right.
All right, let's go smaller, let's go faster.
See, and I guess that's, you know, a lot of what I took out of it was that, look, you know, the NBA has absolutely moved small over the last, you know, however long, decade, whatever. But ultimately, you're not necessarily hurting yourself a lot if you do stay big. And I guess as a Jazz fan, that was a little bit reassuring to say, you know, this favors Gobert thing, for example, can work out long term.
Sure. And I think that's a difference between, you know, the Pacers situation where Roy Hibbert, for kind of his talents as a rim protector and a defender, isn't necessarily someone who can exploit a smaller matchup on him, either through his own scoring, offensive rebounding, and stuff like that. Whereas the Jazz, with, you know, Gobert on the offensive rebounds and favors both, you know, on the boards and in the post and the pick and roll game, both can really exploit smaller defenders much better. And so that's a way where, all right, maybe we're giving something up quickness-wise if the other team goes small, but they're giving up a lot on their own defensive end too. Mm-hmm. And we think we win in the wash. And that's at least a big difference between any sort of decision Utah might have to make versus, again, we talked about Indiana, versus, you know, the decision to, all right, we're going to move on from Roy Hibbert and you know, play Paul George at the four, kind of, sort of, not really, even though C.J. Miles has really been guarding
more than Paul
George has.
Right. All right, well, Seth, thank you so much for joining us. That was really interesting on a number of different topics. Tell everyone where we can read your stuff.
A lot of the stuff I write, you can find at nyloncalculus.com. Follow me on Twitter, at Seth Partnow. Also, have stuff coming out once or twice a week on the Fancy Stats blog at WashingtonPost.com.
Cool. All right, Seth, thank you again so much for joining us.